your headlines. The latest round of the JCPOA Joint Commission talks in Vienna ends with apparently no results. Talks will continue. The US says, quote, if Iran sticks to the position that every sanction has to be removed or there will be no deal, then we are heading towards an impasse. And Turkey says the US plans to send two warships to the Black Sea as Russia has accused NATO of powers of increasing naval activity in the region. Good to have you with us. Our top story, the latest meeting of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action's Joint Commission in Vienna appears to have ended without a breakthrough. Iran's top nuclear negotiator says the negotiations on reviving the 2015 nuclear deal should still continue after 3 days of intensive discussions. Abbas Araghchi said the process of the removal of sanctions is highly complicated and requires more negotiations. Araghchi stressed that his country must see the effects of the removal of US sanctions in practice before it returns to compliance with the JCPOA.
Well, what we mean by verification is to see the effects of sanctions lifting in practice. So it is not enough for the U.S. to sign, you know, waivers or, I don't know, executive orders, whatever. Yes, they have to officially sign, but what matters for us is to see the effect of sanction lifting on the ground.
Araghchi said Iran insists on verifying the U.S. removal of sanctions. Araghchi stressed that all sanctions imposed, reimposed, and relabeled under the former U.S. administration must be removed. The Iranian deputy foreign minister said almost all of the participants in the talks agreed that the U.S. must remove sanctions first to rejoin the deal before Iran resumes its compliance. And the U.S. says, quote, if Iran sticks to the position that every sanction imposed since 2017 has to be removed or there will be no deal, then we are heading towards an impasse. A senior U.S. official said Washington has seen signs of Iranian seriousness of purpose, but not enough during the talks in Vienna, which are held without direct U.S. participation. The official said the U.S. has relayed some serious ideas on how to come back to the deal if Tehran returns to compliance. The official claimed the U.S. is waiting for its efforts to be, quote, reciprocated by Iran. Tehran has time and again said that the United States must remove all the sanctions imposed on Iran before it reverses its nuclear deal commitment cuts. Elsewhere, the Yemeni army says it has carried out a successful drone strike against targets at Saudi Arabia's Abha International Airport. Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Sari said the strike conducted by a Qasid 2K drone was in response to Saudi Arabia's escalation of aggression and continuous siege of Yemen. However, the Saudi-led coalition claims it intercepted and destroyed a Yemeni explosives-laden drone heading towards Khamis Mushayyad, a city east of Abha. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have been carrying out retaliatory attacks since then. They have vowed to continue the raids until Saudi Arabia stops its aggression. Dates are a staple of the Middle East and some other parts of Asia. For Muslims, they're the food of choice for breaking the fast during Ramadan. But Muslims living in the EU and Britain are being asked not to eat just any date. And as Saeed Poreza reports, it's all to do with where they're coming from.
Dates, one of the fruits of paradise in Islamic tradition. With their paper-thin skin and juicy, sweet flesh, they have pride of place, especially on Muslim dinner tables.
Walking to any halal shop or indeed any supermarket here in the UK, and you're bound to see dates on display. They come from many different places, including from Palestinian territories. And during Ramadan, they simply fly off the shelf. But could the Muslims living here in Britain, by taking dates to break their fast during the holy month, be unknowingly supporting the brutal Israeli occupation of Palestinians?
We put that question to the head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, an NGO running a campaign to boycott Israeli dates in the UK, now Israel's third target market.
They were breaking their fast on a date which has been grown on stolen land, which is actually even unlawful, to break your fast with something which is haram.
Israel is one of the world's top five exporters of dates. In 2018, the UK was Israel's largest market for dates worth more than $25 million. Over half of those are grown in illegal settlements, ruled by the United Nations, the International Court of Justice, and several other international organizations as illegal and built on stolen Palestinian land. Not only that, Israeli settlers are set to employ low-paid Palestinian laborers, among them children, to do the back-breaking job of picking the dates. But how are Muslims and non-Muslim Palestinian rights activists to ensure that the dates they're eating are not from the illegal Israeli settlements?
Israelis, instead of coming out and saying product of Israel, they are hiding the identity of the dates. Packages like this, you know, Al-Malik, you know, a Muslim name, Arabic writing, product of Palestine. But when you look, you realize it's a con, because there is no company importer or distributor attached to this.
This year's call to boycott Israeli dates subscribes to the mission of the Global Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement that works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and pressure Israel to comply with international law.
We were in Britain number one importer of Israeli dates. Last year we informed everyone that we have become second, and this year we have become third. And at the same time, Palestinian dates are being sort of supported and imported more.
This Ramadan, when Muslims in Britain break their fast with dates, they'll be wise to ask themselves if the dates they're eating are helping ease the suffering of Palestinians, or are they going towards oppressing them? Saeed Pourreza, London.
So the latest round of the JCPOA Joint Commission talks in Vienna ends with apparently no result. Talks will continue. Meanwhile, the U.S. says, quote, if Iran sticks to the position that every sanction has to be removed or there will be no deal, then we are heading towards an impasse. I'm pleased to bring in Aina Tengen, author and columnist from Beijing. Mr. Tengen, how do you view the ongoing talks in Vienna? I know you don't have a crystal ball. How do you think they will conclude?
Well, let's hope that for everybody's sake that they conclude in a positive manner. I think there is, at this juncture, given the way that Biden's administration has been working since they've come into office, that this is a kind of maneuvering first offer, see exactly what Iran does in regard to this. Obviously, this was a situation where the U.S. walked away from an agreement. It did so, you know, unilaterally without giving, you know, it wasn't proper. So at this juncture, it would make most sense for both sides to come together and just go back to the point where it was left off. But the U.S., politically, very difficult for Biden administration. They want something that they can say, look, I got a better deal, you know, than you know, we had, and therefore that's why we should go forward with this. Obviously, that does not work politically for Iran. Why should they be giving up something which they feel that they're entitled to based on the already completed negotiations prior to? So at this point, it's, as I said, posturing. Both sides are trying to figure out exactly how it can be pulled together.
So what do you make of Iran's argument that Washington must lift all sanctions that were imposed during the Trump era before it returns to compliance with the JCPOA?
Well, as I said, you can be dead right. It's like stepping out in front of a speeding car when you're in the crosswalk and you have the light. You know, Iran might be entitled to ask for this, but the political realities are that a number of years, almost 4 years, have gone by, and there are political realities both for Iran and for the United States that have to be observed. I mean, it's just very difficult, especially in this highly charged political climate. The U.S. is stepping away, creating vacuums in certain places, stepping up their pressure campaigns and others, especially against China and Iran. So at this point, it would just, there has to be some at least visible negotiation. Both sides are going to have to compromise a little bit, not, I don't think, in terms of the substance, but just to get this thing acceptable politically to both sides. Iran has an election coming up shortly. This is not the time for its leadership to, be seen to be kowtowing to the U.S. And as I said, the Republicans are simply waiting for Biden to reimpose the status quo that was before, so they can jump on him and say that he is giving away America.
So something needs to happen to get the ball rolling. Just finally, Mr. Tengen, just expanding a little bit on my earlier question, to what extent do you think the American delegation in Vienna acknowledges that the sanctions imposed during the Trump era, they hurt Iranians, they killed Iranians? These are facts on the ground.
Yes, I mean the fact that both U.S. and Iran were involved in kind of a underground war, not always underground. I mean, there was the killing of the commander using missiles. That has been an ongoing reality for some time. It was hoped that the JCPOA would bring an end to that when the U.S. unilaterally withdrew. Both sides continued to press their points. Iran has its claims. The U.S. will undoubtedly say that they have theirs. But at this juncture, it's not about talking about the past. You can't change it. At this point, it would behoove both sides to figure out how this deal can be done. Iran has suffered in the past. The only good revenge, and true revenge, is to live well. So hopefully this deal will be completed with no material modifications, but simply some sort of face saving on both sides that allows it to go forward. I think that Biden's administration is trying to do something. But as I said, they want to have something where they can declare victory, and that is not going to be acceptable to Iran.
Okay, Mr. Tengen, thank you very much indeed for your time. Minor Tengen there, joining us out of Beijing. And moving on, Turkey says the U.S. plans to send two military ships through the Bosphorus, that is, straits into the Black Sea next week. The Pentagon has declined comments on Ankara's claim, but said the U.S. Navy routinely operates in the region. This comes amid Russia's expression of concern over increased activities in the region by NATO powers and countries that do not border the waters. Tensions have been running high between Moscow and Washington since President Joe Biden took office in January. The U.S. and Russia are at odds over a number of issues, including the conflict in Ukraine and the jailing of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. The United States, France, and Germany have called on Russia to halt a troop buildup on the borders with Ukraine and reaffirmed their support for Kiev in its confrontation with Moscow. Apparently, there's a confrontation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken held separate phone calls with his German and French counterparts, where they discussed the increasing tensions between Kiev and Moscow. The NATO members described Russia's military buildup as a provocation and condemned what they called Russia's inflammatory and irresponsible rhetoric. Meanwhile, Moscow is accusing Kiev of taking provocative measures near its borders. Russia has pledged to defend its citizens in the Flashpoint region, depending on the scale of the military conflict there. Ukraine has also urged NATO to speed up the country's membership plan, heating up tensions with Russia.
Right hand and repeat after me.
Since Joe Biden took office in the U.S., relations between Washington and Moscow have only spiraled downwards. The Biden administration has signaled a more confrontational approach towards Russia. It has already hit Moscow with economic sanctions over the jailing of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Washington has also threatened unspecified action over an alleged massive cyber attack, which it blames on Russia. Tensions have risen particularly after Biden publicly stated that he thinks Putin is a killer. Now, the Russian government says it will respond in kind to any new U.S. sanctions amid reports that the White House is about to announce further bans against Russia. This time, the source of tensions is the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Over the past 2 weeks, mainstream Western media outlets have been reporting about an increase in Russia's military presence along its borders with Ukraine. This coincides with reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine, leaving a ceasefire in the region effectively dead. Ukraine, the US and NATO accused Russia of sending troops and heavy weaponry to prop up militias in the region. But the Kremlin says there is nothing to fear, describing the repositioning of Russian armed units as a domestic issue. Analysts believe Russia's military buildup along the border with Ukraine is a response to Kiev's saber-rattling.
This buildup of Russian troops is actually, to the contrary, it is in response to saber-rattling by Ukraine that is being instigated by the United States and in the form of NATO.
The notion that Russia is responding to Ukraine's escalation does not seem far from reality. Some observers believe Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is in a weak position at home, is playing the anti-Russian card to appease the nationalist population and mobilize support in the West. They cite a recent crackdown on pro-Russia media and figures, as well as Zelensky's public call on NATO to speed up Ukraine's membership plan. The Kremlin, which has repeatedly voiced concern over NATO's eastward expansion, bitterly opposes the notion that Ukraine could someday join the Western military alliance. After all, Biden has been one of Kiev's staunchest supporters since before the outbreak of the conflict in eastern Ukraine in 2014. This week, Biden himself pledged unwavering support to the Ukrainian government. It remains to be seen how far the new U.S. administration is ready to go in its confrontational path on Russia. If the current trajectory continues, soon we will see a full-scale war of sanctions between the two governments at the least.
Now, the U.S. State Department has issued new guidelines that enable officials to meet more freely with Taiwanese counterparts. The State Department spokesman said the aim of the guidelines is to encourage the U.S. government's engagement with Taiwan. Ned Price said this deepens what he called unofficial relationship with the territory. The announcement comes amid heightened tensions between Washington and Beijing over the Chinese territory. This week, Beijing slammed Washington for sailing a warship through the Taiwan Strait again. China has also condemned the U.S. arms deals with Taiwan. Turning to other news, the novel coronavirus and its more contagious variants continue to take their toll on European countries. Italy has registered around 19,000 new infections and 718 deaths. The number of fatalities saw a big rise compared to around 500 on the previous day. Italy is the second biggest victim of the pandemic in Europe, with around 3.6 million infections and nearly 114,000 deaths. Britain, the hardest-hit European country, reported over 3,000 new infections, raising its total caseload to over 4.3 million. A further 60 people were reported to have died, raising its death toll to over 127,000. The government said around 32 million Britons have so far received at least one vaccine dose in one of the biggest vaccination drives worldwide. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
COVID-19 has brutally exposed and deepened inequality both within and between countries, and highlighted the staggering disregard for shared humanity, says Brett Wilkins, writer, in an article published under the heading Amnesty International's Annual Global Human Rights Report Details Harm and Heroism Amid Pandemic. Stay tuned for more. Offering an incisive overview of the world in this era and focusing largely on how governments have responded or failed to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, Amnesty International recently released its annual Global Human Rights Report. Amnesty International Report 2020, 21st, The State of the World's Human Rights, examines human rights in 149 countries, highlighting how people who were already among the world's most marginalized, including refugees, women, racial and religious minorities, and the poor, suffered the brunt of the impact of COVID-19 pandemic. COVID-19 and its mass casualties flourished in part thanks to global milieu of deeper, broader inequalities within and between countries, the report asserts. It has been made far worse by austerity policies that weakened public infrastructure and public health systems, by international architecture, enfeebled in form, function, and leadership. And it has been made far worse under pressure from leaders of states who demonize and exclude, asserting archaic constructs of state sovereignty and peddling rejectionist approaches to science, evidence, and universal norms. The report takes aim at wealthy countries accused of stockpiling coronavirus vaccine doses while depriving less developed nations of the life-saving medications, a practice that many observers have called vaccine apartheid. While the World Health Organization's COVAX facility represented a positive global initiative aimed at ensuring more countries could access vaccines, it was undermined by the non-participation of the USA, the hoarding of vaccines by rich countries, and the failure of companies to share their intellectual property, it states. More than 90 countries introduced export restrictions affecting items including medical equipment, PPE, personal protective equipment, pharmaceutical products, and food. Wealthy states also blocked adoption of a proposal at the World Trade Organization for a temporary waiver of intellectual property rights for COVID-19 products that was designed to facilitate universal access, the report continues. The report details how the pandemic has exacerbated the already precarious existence of people, including refugees, migrants, and asylum seekers, as well as women and workers in informal economy. It also notes that authoritarian regimes around the world have used the pandemic as a pretext to repress human rights. Amnesty International Secretary General Agnes Callamard said in a statement that COVID-19 has brutally exposed and deepened inequality both within and between countries, and highlighted the staggering disregard that statesmen have for shared humanity. Decades of divisive policies, misguided austerity measures, and choices by statesmen not to invest in crumbling public infrastructure have left too many easy prey to this virus. We are reaping the results of years of calculated neglect at the hands of the statesman Callimard added. In 2020, under the unique strain of a pandemic, health systems have been put to the ultimate test and people have been left in financial freefall, while those who gave the most were protected the least. The report isn't all gloom and doom. It hails the exceptional leadership that came not from power, privilege, or profits, but rather from nurses, doctors, and health workers on the front line of life-saving services. The report adds that leadership also came from those who cared for older people and from technicians and scientists running millions of tests and trials, frantically searching for vaccines. It came from those who bunched together more often at every bottom of the income scale, worked to feed the rest of us, who cleared our streets, cared for the bodies of the hundreds of thousands of diseased, repaired our essential services, patrolled our streets, drew what remained of our public transport, it states. It adds, in 2020, as so much of the world shut down, it was those people who stood up, who stood out. So to those who stayed home in solidarity, if they had a home to live in, who maintained emotionally costly physical distance, and who cared for those around them.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining me and my wonderful guests on today's episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have the honor and pleasure of having my brothers in faith and humanity join us on today's interesting discussion. To my left, I have the one and only, Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh, Sister Zainab. Again, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure
thank
to be with you.
Thank you for joining us, bro.
My name is Brother Yasser. I am from South Africa.
MashaAllah.
I have been here too long. We hope to benefit.
What are you doing here? Why have you been here for so long?
I've been studying in the Islamic Seminary for the last 11 years. I'm just finishing my master's.
May Allah increase your tawfiq and prolong Inshallah. Your life. And to my right, I have my special brother and guest. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us.
This is Ayman Rizvi, and I am actually in the Hawza as well for mm-hmm. about 7 to 8 years.
MashaAllah.
Finishing up my second master's program here. I've spent some time in the States as well by working there. Half of my family lives there.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I wanted to learn about, Islam, and that is why I'm here now.
MashaAllah, and blessing and tawfiq.
Thank you.
So today we're going to be talking about this trending expression, and it has become so serious that we can't even call it a culture at this point. And it is a culture of self-care and self-love that has been prevailing, especially in Western societies. And it goes like talking about things regarding putting ourselves as a priority, not being able to pour from an empty cup. And in order to love others, you must first love yourself, and you have to take care of yourself first so you can take care of those who are under your care and protection, basically, i.e. your children, your spouse, or whoever it is that depends on you for any matter in life, to be perfectly honest. And I just wanted to discuss this mainly, I mean, firstly, we can talk about it, whether it is defined within an Eastern culture, an Eastern, the Eastern sphere of the world as well, the Eastern part of the world. And also whether it has a place in Islam, such a concept.
The question you asked, Susan, can be, is multifaceted. You know, you can answer from many different perspectives. For example, the last question you asked about the East, I don't think you can say that anymore because of the culture being so passed on or kind of finding its way into the East. It's such a rapid pace.
True.
You can't really find a separate culture anymore. And also because of globalization and so on, can you actually say that, no, this is what that is, and this is what, you know, can, well, what is the differentiator between all of these different cultures that we have? But in terms of the actual question about oneself, loving oneself, this is an Islamic concept to a certain extent. We have what is known as hubbu dhat, that a person loves his own essence.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is something that the ancient Islamic philosophers, Ibn Sina and the like, have spoken about. But the difference between Islamic philosophy and then obviously that Western background is that Islamic philosophers and mystics have provided a program and a means by which this is governed.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas obviously on the other spectrum, there is no such program.
Yeah.
They say ethics, but then there's a whole discussion. What do we mean by ethics? Is ethics something real? Is it a whole discussion? We don't want to get into it. So the main crux of the matter is this, is yes, we as human beings have this within ourselves. We want everything that is good for us, for ourselves, and we want to push everything that is bad for us away from. This is something natural. It's not something that, you know, we require a lot to think about.
Yeah.
But the question is, how is it then governed? Does it become law of the jungle, as they say? You know, each for their own, and so on and so forth. This is on the philosophical level. The second question you asked is that, yes, obviously a person who needs to look after himself must be healthy in order to perform his other duties. This, again, is an Islamic principle. Again, how it is done, the means it is done, the time, the schedule, and the means by which it is done is obviously given to you by the lawgiver, the Shari, which is completely different from, you know, a lawgiver who is from your own ilk, from a human being. So obviously we'll see these differences coming up. So this is the theoretic or the theory behind the differences.
I think this notion of put yourself first, it has its roots in history. If you look in the European history, you would find out that church was very hard on people in the beginning, and then there were atrocities, and you know, then the humanism came, and then after that, you know, right now in the Western world, usually the word individuality or the individual rights have been prevailed a lot. And the West has effects everywhere, even on the East as well. So you can understand that, you know, these are basically the Western concepts, mainly because they have their strong history.
Mm, they have their struggles that led to this point, basically.
Yes, of course. And now, in these times, you know, in the times of imperialism or in the times of materialism, they have become a little bit irrational.
Mm-hmm.
They have become cruel in a sense that now they are telling people to go out of the way, totally out of the way,
mm-hmm.
you know, out of their soul, the way of their soul. Because mm-hmm. the human soul is basically, if you can say, it's about loving other people as well. You know, a lot of billionaires, as we see right now, like Bill Gates or whoever, you know, the Facebook's
Zuckerberg,
yeah. Everyone is now helping others. They have opened their own foundations, and they're doing anthropology work. So why are you working now for the people, right? So it was actually mainly the work of a soul, the goal of a soul, that, you know, you need to love others, you need to help others out. But unfortunately, you know, the materialism and these concepts are cruel, so... Mm-hmm.
But when we look at it that way, that, okay, sure, the West had its own struggles that led to this point, and people just, it's like they're overcompensating for a very harsh past, totally understandable. But then we look at other cultures, especially countries that were colonized, And we're like, well, don't they have more justification to adopt such mentality? Like, the entire, well, not the entire, but most of the African continent could be like, oh, we were taken as slaves, though. So if anyone should practice self-care, it should be us. So why isn't this concept prevailing in the continent of Africa or in the subcontinent of India or Southeast Asian countries that were torn up by wars, Middle Eastern countries that were ripped apart, you know? So I can't help but think that it has its root in, like, what you said, bro, that individualism, that whole to each his own, it's actually a dog-eat-dog kind of world, and we're all each other's sharks sort of thing. Maybe it's not that human. Maybe it's not that lovey-dovey. Maybe it's not that rainbows and butterflies after all. You were talking about it has roots in Islam. You repeated that a lot. Could you give me a few examples of how?
For example?
Islam is all about selflessness, though.
Will you drink a cup of poison?
Yeah, but I won't let...
Yes, you will?
No, no. No, I mean, yeah, I get your point, but yeah, that's what I meant. I like disregarded the answer entirely. No, I won't, but I won't give it to someone under my care either.
What? Who tells you to do that? They said this is governed by the lawgiver, the Sharia. For example, when it comes to giving, charity, there are laws to it. We have twice in history of an imam giving half of his wealth away completely.
Allah, Allah.
Why not all?
Oh, the other half is for him,
for himself,
his family, his kids.
He has his own family, his own responsibilities to do.
Yeah.
Second, he's also a role model for others.
Uh-huh.
Why not the whole, the imam?
But the mother of that imam that you speak of, her eminence, she sat down to prayer and she was like, Al-Jar, Thumma Dar. First purpose.
But Thumma Dar, this doesn't mean not Dar. Laysa fit Dar. She didn't say Laysa fit Dar.
She's like, neighbors first and then us.
So still us.
There's yeah, still but there should us. Be other people before
doesn't matter.
Herself. I
doesn't
mean, like,
matter.
When we talk about the history of Islam
the
or
point
the character
is,
of Fatima al-Zahra, she was then, all about give everything you have to others, even if you have to starve and break your fast
exactly.
with water.
But still, there had to be certain responsibility. For example, when that those people came to the house, again, just go forward, right? The orphan and the slave and so on. The imam never forced anybody to give it.
True.
They give it out of their own accord.
Yeah.
If they didn't, would there be anything wrong on them?
No.
Secondly, that group of individuals, you cannot compare them to anybody else as well.
That is
so
also
that's another completely out of the discussion
that
as well.
That is so true. Because once they starved themselves on like on day three, they had food from heaven.
Exactly.
Come down.
For even then, Bibi Maryam Salamullah Alayha, even then, Imam Ali himself says, you will never be able to do what I do.
True.
Don't even try it.
Yes.
Don't live like I live.
What because I tried that for a while, and it was like a one-way ticket to the hospital for me. My blood pressure dropped so
imam
wild.
Imam is telling you, you are not me.
Yeah.
I'm different in terms of my spiritual, whatever. Out of words, you can't compare.
Yeah.
So come down, but look at the companions of the imams and so on. Like, they were told to do certain things. Do this, do that.
Mm.
Keep this for yourself. Protect yourself. Protect your family. Sometimes they were told to flee even, to protect themselves.
Their lives, yeah.
Why? The imam is showing that protect yourself for a better goal.
Mm,
so the better goal may be, for example, there are examples. Like, I'll give a better example. There were certain companions of the imams who had to do extreme taqiyah. There's no good word for it in English, but they said dissimulation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a good word, but anyway. For example, you have at the time of Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, a person by the name of Ali ibn Yaqtin.
Mm-hmm.
Ali ibn Yaqtin worked in the court of Mansur, who was the second Abbasid Khalif, who was one of the worst Abbasid Khalifs there was. But he worked there under the command of the Imam.
All right.
And he took money from that court. And he got a wage from it for his family. But the Imam said, but your job is to
we need an inside man.
All the other Shia that will come to you.
Yeah. Allah, Allah.
And there's many other stories regarding Ali ibn Yaqtin and Ali Yaqtin, that certain family. So it's not something, if you go outside of the imams and the companions, and look at our time, for example, like, you will see that our ulama and our great scholars themselves, they would have to look after themselves to at least the minimum to stay alive. We have an Islamic law, right? If you are dying, right, you can eat something haram to keep yourself alive.
If you're dying, though, okay.
But exactly. You still have to look after yourself.
So I think what, I think it would be safe for us to say that this concept of self-care, put yourself first, has a place in Islam in comparison with a greater good. Because I feel like in the Western society, right, which is totally void of spirituality and the unseen and the higher power, which, like you said, governs everything, put yourself first for the sake of yourself. Look, khalas, yes, done. Exactly, yeah. Right?
It depends on what that person's access is.
If exactly.
Your access is God-centric, you still
feel. Exactly.
If, as a brother says, if your access is humanism and individualism, it's different.
Yes, brother, you said you lived in the States for a while, so I imagine you're familiar with their cultures. Could you say, even from personal experience, right? Could you say that Westerners are in any way, shape, or form more selfish than Eastern people?
I think it's because of the media or usually, you know, the systems compel people to become such things, you know. Such as selfish beings. But in reality, you know, if you look at even person look at his own soul, you will find out that you are more happy in giving.
True.
You know, I have, for example, I know that personally, when I helped a kid from a neighborhood, I taught him, right? I didn't charge him money. I taught him free. That feeling stayed in my heart. You know, till now, or right. probably it will stay there for the rest of my life, right? But if I have probably charged him money knowing that he cannot pay, then that would be a burden on my heart.
Exactly. You'd even feel guilty about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, human soul is about giving. Let me give you an example from Arif. His last name is Nikui. I don't remember his full name.
Right.
He wrote. He didn't write the name, but people compiled his incidents and events in a book called Alexa.
Mm-hmm.
So a person came to him and asked him, "Give me advice."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Serve the people."
Mm-hmm.
He stayed there and he thought that I should ask him more questions. He asked the second question. He said, "Tell me the second advice." He said, "Serve the people," and it happened the third time as well. Mm-hmm. So he. You know, thrice he said, serve the people.
Mm.
And even if you look at our Urufa, you know, the contemporary Urufa, or maybe who have lived like 5 or 10 years ago, or all the scholars, look at their houses, look at their lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I understand, I agree with brother, you know, but in order to help others, you need to be sustain yourself, first of all. There is no doubt about that. But of course, I mean, in the end, it's all about giving. It's not about taking, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. There is a sense of fulfillment, gratification, self-empowerment, another word that is prevailing in the Western society right now, in giving, in not being so self-centered, right? In focusing on others, because at the end of the day, even the Quran says, لَن تَنَالُوا الْبِرَّ حَتَّى تُنْفِقُوا مِمَّا تُحِبُّونَ. You will not reach any goodness until you give from what you love. And I think the greatest example we can find in Islam for that is the martyrs. The act of sacrificing your own life for others' security and for the satisfaction of Allah is an act of self-love. Because at the end of the day, you are the one who's going to earn paradise.
What more could be done, you know, than giving your life away for the people?
Yeah, there could be a lot. I mean, there are a lot of examples and manifestations of that act of self-love. And one of the greatest ones is martyrdom. That's all the time we have for today's episode of Back to Reality. Thank you so very much for being with us. Thank you to my brothers and guests. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
Our voice comes from from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. For years, it had been assumed that superior skills in facial recognition could be taught and would help those working in police and security agencies to make more accurate judgments about a person's identity. While this is true up to a point, research has found that the remarkable abilities demonstrated by super recognizers can't be learned. Researchers think they are coded into our DNA, and only a very small proportion of people have the genetic disposition to develop these extreme abilities. Dr. James Dunn, from the University of New South Wales in Australia, says the term super recognizers was coined by researchers in 2009 in response to some of the exceptional results people were achieving on face recognition tests. In statistical terms, super recognizer describes anyone who scores two standard deviations above the average person. In other words, a person in the top 1 or 2% of the population. Dr. James Dunn said, "What we've found is that face recognition varies naturally, like IQ does. And just like IQ, it appears that a large proportion of that variance is genetically determined." We now present you an article written by researchers at the University of New South Wales in Australia under the heading, "Super Recognizers Possess Extraordinary Ability to Memorize and Recall Faces." The article has been taken from the SciTechDaily.com website. Please stay with us for more. While in Paris, France in the 1990s, Georgie briefly watched a professional photographer taking pictures of kids playing in a small park near Les Halles and thought nothing of it. 10 years later, she was having breakfast in Australia's Byron Bay backpackers and asked the man next to her whether he was a photographer and if he had ever taken pictures of children playing in a Paris park. Amazed, he only said that he was and that he had. He even showed her his portfolio of the actual pictures she had witnessed him taking a decade earlier. Coincidences like these would probably go unnoticed by most of us, but Georgie has a special ability that only 2% of the world's population is endowed with. She is a super recognizer. Such people possess an extraordinary ability to memorize and recall faces of people they may have only encountered in the most unremarkable and sometimes fleeting situations, often many years before. In research published in PLOS-1, psychologists from the Forensic Psychology Laboratory at University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, argue that the freely available University of New South Wales face test, which they have been using since 2017 to identify the world's best performing super recognizers, is a perfect screening tool to sort the good, the very good, and the exceptional face recognizers from the rest of the population. The researchers, including Dr. James Dunn, Scientia Fellow Dr. David White, and Dr. Alice Towler, say the University of New South Wales face test is able to provide more precision when it comes to ranking the abilities of super recognizers, especially when used in conjunction with existing face recognition tests, like the Glasgow Face Matching Test and the Cambridge Face Memory Test. The University of New South Wales face test was deliberately designed by the researchers to be very challenging. As a result, average performers rank at the low end of the scale. Unlike other existing tests where performance of candidates is more evenly spread across the measurement scale. Out of 31,000 people who have taken the University of New South Wales face test since 2017, nobody has ever scored 100%. The highest anyone has achieved is 97%. This means the person with the best facial recognition abilities in the world could still be out there. Dr. James Dunn says, when people do the University of New South Wales face test, they discover it's really difficult, with most people scoring between 50 and 60%. He says, but super recognizers are people who score 70% and higher. We made it difficult so that it's not too easy for the very best super recognizers, adding, when super recognizers do the traditional face test, they max out at 100%, which means it's difficult for us to differentiate between the very good and the exceptionally good. Dr. James Dunn notes, if anybody came to us thinking they may be a super recognizer, we would start them on the University of New South Wales face test and then get them to do further confirmatory tests and say, you need to do well on all of them for us to be confident that you're a super recognizer. For many years, it had been assumed that superior skills in facial recognition could be taught and would help those working in police force and security agencies to make more accurate judgments about a person's identity. While this is true up to a point, new research has found that the remarkable abilities demonstrated by super recognizers can't be learnt. Researchers think they are coded into our DNA, and only a very small proportion of the population have the genetic disposition to develop these extreme abilities. Dr. James Dunn says, the term super recognizers was coined by researchers in 2009 in response to some of the exceptional results people were achieving on face recognition tests. In statistical terms, super recognizer describes anyone who scores two standard deviations above the average person. In other words, a person in the top 1 or 2% of the population. Dr. James Dunn continues, what we've found is that face recognition varies naturally like IQ does, and just like IQ, it appears that a large proportion of that variance is genetically determined. The University of New South Wales researchers are interested in super recognizers for two reasons. First of all, the more scientists learn about super recognizers and how they process faces, the more they can decode what is going on in the brain when we see both familiar and unfamiliar faces. And secondly, governments and commercial organizations are increasingly searching for people with superior face recognition abilities. Dr. James Dunn adds, we are starting to see industries looking within and outside of their organizations for super recognizers to work in specialized face identification roles. He added, this can include police, but may also include government and commercial bodies like immigration, intelligence agencies, security agencies, financial institutions, and even coffee shops. According to new research, there are no other common traits shared among super recognizers besides their skill itself. Super recognizers come from all walks of life and have the same spread of intelligence profiles as the general population. While many may not realize they are super recognizers, some had an inkling they were pretty good with faces at a young age. Nicole was just 11 years old when she realized she could recognize all her teacher's baby faces in a competition at her school. She says, when everyone else was struggling to find just a couple of faces they knew, I correctly identified all 20 faces very easily. At the time, I thought it was strange, but it felt super cool too. Likewise, Wai Yin said she first realized she was a super recognizer when still a teenager. She added, I used to look at magazines and circle people's faces instead of looking at the clothes. That's when I thought there's something weird going on. For Kelly, it wasn't until she sat at the University of New South Wales face test and was contacted by researchers that she even knew that she had the skill. But she adds, I have always been a perfectionist and had an extremely abnormal eye for detail with everything. A lot of super recognizers start to wonder about their gift when watching television. Jessica says, my husband and I were arguing over somebody on television looking like someone else, adding, my husband said he thought he was pretty good at recognizing faces and Googled and found the University of New South Wales' online test. He completed it and achieved around 50%. She says, I completed the test and had a much higher score and thought, I'm definitely better at recognizing faces than my husband. Automatic win on that topic. It wasn't until the University of New South Wales researchers contacted me that I realized my score was not within the normal range. I joined a lot of dots after that. Most see the skill as a gift that makes life more interesting or even helps in one's career. Duncan says being a super recognizer has helped in his line of work, which is recruitment. Duncan says, people are always extremely flattered when you remember them, or if we haven't actually met in person and have only seen their picture on social media, they are usually pretty shocked. But others with the gift are a bit more cautious about exposing it. Marcus says, it can make things quite awkward. Marcus added, I'm quite social, so I tend to walk up to people and remember, and I soon realize they don't remember me. Sally resorts to hiding her skill. She says, I often have to lie that I've never met or seen people before, adding, it freaks them out. Or I saw you last week at Woolworths. Makes you sound like a stalker. Amanda reports a similar observation. She says, on a daily basis, I have given up on saying things to people like, hello, we were talking in the queue at Coles supermarket last week. Do you remember me? I just got too many weird looks and I started to feel like I was creepy sometimes, again thinking people would recognize me like I can recognize them. In the end, David says the super recognizer trait can be a mixed blessing. David added, being good at recognition comes with its own problems, feeling like the world is too small sometimes, but it has its good parts too. It's allowed me in the leisure industry to build a good rapport with customers, and I can remember every single customer. Having developed the University of New South Wales face test to find super recognizers, the research team now plans to invite many of them into the laboratory to understand exactly why they are so super at face recognition.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.